This is Women's Magazines from Sun Sounds Radio. I'm reader Ruth Bronstein. Our first article is from the November issue of Cosmopolitan magazine, The New State of Dating at Work. Despite a post-hashtag MeToo corporate push to cancel office hookup culture, millennial women are actually feeling just as empowered as ever to date their colleagues. Here, an exclusive Cosmo survey by Dana Evans. You'd think in 2019 that the workplace would be a deeply unsexy place to date. After hashtag MeToo, companies unleashed stricter policies targeting office romances. They canceled holiday parties to discourage anyone from getting a little too close, bought in anti-flirting coaches, and required already coupled co-workers to sign love contracts, so it was clear and on paper that those relationships were consensual. Talk about an awkward threesome, you, your partner, and HR. Maybe that's why people assumed women were thinking twice or never about hooking up with a colleague. Except we still are, maybe more so now than ever before. The proof? Cosmo asked more than 800 women between the ages of 18 and 35 how they view love on the job. 84% were totally down to date someone at their company, as long as they're not on the same team. We are overambitious millennials who spend all our time at work. So yeah, this tracks. The hashtag MeToo movement definitely hasn't changed my thoughts on dating or hooking up in the workplace, says Chantel, 35, who works in finance. I don't think it should be a free-for-all, but it's only natural to feel attracted to your coworkers. In fact, 40% of women have hooked up with a coworker post-hashtag MeToo. 62% are cool with cross-cubicle flirting, and 72% have a friend who dated someone they worked with. Slack is an all-meeting follow-ups. Lauren, 29, whose job is in media, says, I genuinely liked dating someone I worked with. We had the same interests, obviously, and understood each other's work, so it gave us a lot to talk about. They also shared similar schedules and a hatred of the crappy free coffee in the break room. So romantic. What has changed is the added pressure to keep inter-office relationships on the DL, given all the new rules. My boyfriend and I were wary of making moves, says Chloe, 23, who works in a government office. So we ended up keeping it a secret. We had to hide behind a tree one time because we saw someone from work. Eventually, her boyfriend decided it was time to break up with his job, not with her, so they wouldn't have to deal. A column reads, What the Numbers Show. 84% of you are cool with dating someone at your company as long as they're not on your team. 62% are comfortable flirting with a coworker. 61% have been on a date with a colleague. 55% have met a romantic partner on the job. 53% know of couples currently dating in your workplace. Only 10% would feel comfortable having a relationship with a boss. Source: Cosmo Survey Monkey. The article continues, and despite the push for men and women to keep it completely platonic, looking for love while on the clock might, in some ways, actually be less of a landmine than it was pre-hashtag Me Too. Linda, 26, a service industry employee, feels that more guys, not all, are on high alert right now. Men know not to pull some shit or else they might be outed for exactly who they are, she says. And women feel especially empowered to choose who they hook up with or don't. The large majority of those who took our survey, 90%, said they would never date their boss and were no longer afraid to say, hell no, if a sleazy supervisor asks us out for drinks. Yet companies are still zeroing in on the very thing that we seem to have under control at work, dating. According to career transitioning firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, 51% of businesses have formal office romance protocols, with an increasing number of employers currently working on one. A caption reads, "The hashtag MeToo movement gave women the power to say no to a hookup and to say yes." The article continues, "A no dating policy in the workplace cements in people's minds that this is about sexual desire, but it's sexual harassment that's about people abusing their power. It's not, I asked her out." When companies get stuck there, they're not addressing the real problem, explains Marianne Cooper, PhD, a sociologist at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. This also assumes that women don't know the difference between an unwanted sexual advance from an office mate and a consensual relationship with a coworker. Please. It wouldn't be fair to leave out the monumental progress the hashtag MeToo movement has had on the workplace, empty desks where all the Harveys used to be, and how it's prompted companies to implement changes that do benefit women, like Facebook's "you can ask someone out only once" policy. Women do need and want HR to have their backs when it comes to the sexism that didn't just disappear because of a hashtag. But telling people they can't have relationships at work doesn't get rid of hyper-masculine cultures or harassment, says Cooper, nor does it really deter us from dating. After all, says Olivia, 22, a nurse, the hashtag MeToo movement gave women the power to say no to a hookup and to say yes. And anyway, these slightly sexist bans can also come with a fucked up side effect. They may further the false narrative that any type of fraternizing with a woman at the office is risky. In 2019, 27% of men avoided one-on-one meetings with female colleagues, according to a survey from the University of Houston, which is a really excellent way for women to get left behind at work. That seems like a punishment, not protection, and definitely not progress. This article is from the November issue of Women's Health, The Great Escape. Those goggle gamers geek out over are actually a tool doctors are now using to treat a slew of health issues. Let's say hello to a new reality. Let's Go for a Ride by Megan Rabbit. Jennifer Fernjack is scuba diving in crystal clear water, surrounded by the most colorful fish she'd ever seen. She happily floats above stunning coral reefs and listens to the soothing hum of the bubbles coming out of her oxygen tank. The ocean is peaceful, and she feels calm as hell. So when her dentist puts his hand on her shoulder to let her know he's done filling her cavity, she doesn't believe him. Fernjack, who used to pass out just thinking about being in the dentist chair, didn't even feel the pinch of the Novocaine shot due to the virtual reality VR equipment that transported her to paradise before a drill descended into a lower molar. She's just one of a growing number of patients and physicians experimenting with VR therapy. She got lucky. Her longtime dentist in Wayzata, Minnesota, started offering VR in his practice and suggested it to her, knowing about her anxiety. The headsets are now being used to lessen the symptoms associated with everything from labor and birth pain to surgery to chemotherapy. What's behind the boom? VR therapy, per se, isn't exactly new. Hunter Hoffman, PhD, director of the Virtual Reality Research Center at the University of Washington, recalls bringing computers the size of mini fridges into hospitals for some of the first studies back in the early 90s. But because of a very rapid spike in VR technology, plus the plummeting price of the equipment, thank you, multi-billion-dollar gaming and porn industry, VR has only recently become super accessible. The first commercially available VR helmets came out in 2016, and in 3 years, the improvement in the tech and the research have been mind-boggling, says Hoffman. No pun intended. Add to that urgent need for non-narcotic relief in the wake of the opioid crisis, and it's easy to understand why VR is taking off for pain-related conditions. How VR's powers work. It's all about diverting your attention and getting you to focus on something more pleasing or stimulating. In other words, distraction on steroids, says Hoffman, once you put on the goggles. A photograph is captioned, "Looking ahead, less pain, more goggles." A box reads, "Alter your world." There's no easy one-stop database that'll tell you who's offering the tech. So talk to your clinician and ask. If they don't offer it, there's a decent chance they know of a provider or a center that does. Otherwise, a trusty Google search can turn up someone in your area who's got the gear, or you can go to clinicaltrials.gov to see if you qualify to join a VR-based research study. Technology is lurching into medicine in a bigger way than ever before. You're preoccupied with what you're seeing, so you don't have extra brain power to feel the pain associated with a treatment or to get yourself worked up over how bad it's going to be. For example, one VR program lets burn victims roam around a frozen cartoon landscape, distracting them from the excruciating moments when nurses change wound dressings and stretch scarred skin. Patients who step into Snow World during these treatments report up to 50% less pain than those who don't don the gear, the headgear, research shows. Another use, in the labor and delivery ward at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, relaxing VR beach scenes that feature a calming voiceover are helping women give birth drug-free if they choose to. The immersive, multisensory nature of the trendy therapy is key, says Walter Greenleaf, PhD, a behavioral neuroscientist and medical technology developer at Stanford University. Yes, you could listen to a practitioner describe a soothing environment, but the real superpower of VR is that it's an experience, not a suggestion of an experience, he says. Also, because VR closes you off to what's happening around you, you're not able to see the doctor getting close to you with a scary long needle, for instance. It can interrupt any fear-based thoughts you're having about what the pain may feel like. By luring the spotlight of attention into a virtual world, patients are less present in the hospital room, which can reduce acute pain, says Hoffman. VR programs can also help treat chronic pain by shifting the way people perceive it. Rebecca Kidd, 33, was dealing with chronic pelvic floor issues and tried immersive VR lessons that taught her about the nature of pain and about breath work, too. My pain used to be at a 5 to 7 out of 10, and now I'm at a 1 or 2, if I have any at all, she says. A tray with instruments and medication is captioned, "Pain meds swapped for VR someday. Wrap your head around that." The article continues, "Why fantasy is the future. To be honest, VR isn't completely mainstream yet. By experts' note, the speed of progress is promising. It could eventually be standard in your doc's office or urgent care. Nervous before a surgery? A VR program specific for the procedure might walk you through what's going to happen, from pre-op prep at home to checking into the hospital to entering the operating room, even to what you can expect post-op. And the potential for VR to transform our health is endless. Technology is lurching into medicine in a bigger way than ever before," says Greenleaf. "If VR continues to evolve at this rate, in the next 10 years, it will become so common in all aspects of medicine that we won't even notice we're using it. Well, except for those sci-fi goggles on your face. But hey, talk about a wellness game changer." A box is titled "Peace of Mind." While physical probs have been the main focus, the psych world uses VR too, says Mimi McFall, PsychD, Deputy Director of the National Mental Health Innovation Center, NMHIC, conditions for which it has major potential. PTSD. Previously, a therapist would urge you to recall details from a trauma in order to help you work through it. With VR, a practitioner guides you back into that situation in such a realistic way that the process is more effective, says Joanne DeFeed, PhD, a psychologist at New York Presbyterian and Weill Cornell Medicine. Phobias and OCD. Traditional exposure therapy is the standard for both, but physically going to the place that prompts so much fear can be a tough sell. With VR, therapists can travel anywhere with their patients, like on a ski lift with someone who's afraid of heights, or on an airplane with a patient who's terrified of flying. Stress and burnout. Mindfulness-based interventions have been proven to up relaxation and boost happiness. Enter VR, which can work like a souped-up guide on set, guided on sesh. Because VR is immersive, it's easier to be in the moment, says Deborah Bolt, PhD, a clinical psychologist and program manager at MHIC. Addiction and eating disorders. By virtually dropping someone into a triggering scenario, say at a bar, therapists can help patients practice how to respond to triggers. This can also manage anticipatory anxiety. What will happen if I'm offered a drink? Because the VR scenario feels so legit, says Greenleaf. Last week, we began an article from the October issue of Oprah. It was titled, "The Agony and Yes, the Ecstasy of Menopause," a different kind of coming-of-age story. We will continue now. A box reads, "Hormone Therapy, Where Are We and How Did We Get Here?" 1993, the Women's Health Initiative, WHI, Hormone Therapy, HT trials, are designed to test the effects of postmenopausal hormone therapy on women's risk for coronary heart disease, bone fractures, and breast cancer. The trials include 27,347 women ages 50 to 79. 2002, the trial of estrogen plus progestin is stopped 3 years early because of increased risk of breast cancer, heart disease, stroke, and blood clots. 2003, the FDA slaps a black box warning on estrogen products. They should not be used to prevent cardiovascular disease and recommends for symptoms like hot flashes, night sweats, and vaginal dryness, the lowest effective dose for the shortest duration. 2004, the trial of estrogen alone is dropped 1 year early because of increased risk of stroke and no overall benefit. Doctors grow wary of recommending HT. Prescriptions for the two most common forms in the U.S., Premarin and Prempro, declined to 21 million from 61 million in 2001. 2005, following the publication of Suzanne Summers' book, The Sexy Years, in which she touts the benefits of bioidentical HT, more women turn to these unregulated, non-FDA-approved formulations obtained from compounding pharmacies. 2006, new WHI data emerges showing that younger women between ages 50 and 59 actually don't face the same alarming risks from HT as postmenopausal women over age 60. 2012, the North American Menopause Society, NAMS, issues a position statement supporting the use of HT to treat disruptive menopausal symptoms like hot flashes, night sweats, and vaginal dryness, but recommends against using estrogen plus progesterone beyond 3 to 5 years. 2017, based on further research from the WHI and other trials, NAMS updates its position statement to say that for the majority of healthy women under age 60 who are within 10 years of menopause and want relief from their symptoms, the benefits of HT outweigh the risks, and that's where we stand today. CP. The article continues, Wen and Christensen are now menopause education evangelists. They've put their lectures on CDs that they send free to other OBGYN programs. And Wen has even developed an app to answer practitioners' treatment questions. NAMS has similarly invested in boosting practitioner know-how by offering a certification program in menopausal health. Any licensed healthcare provider, physician, nurse, naturopath, physician's assistant, pharmacist, social worker, psychologist, can sit for the exam, which consists of 100 multiple-choice questions that test knowledge on everything from the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis to bone mineral density tests to the use of isoflavones and herbs as alternative therapies. Currently, 1,131 practitioners are certified. The NAMS website, menopause.org, has a handy tool to help you find one near you. I could have benefited from seeing such a practitioner myself. Like many women, I was surprised to find that as my ovaries wound down, my periods aggressively ramped up. I bled like crazy, heavily, unpredictably, sometimes in clots so thick, it felt like a vampire cleanse. I went to business meetings, dinners, movies, massively pre-padded. The only thing that stanched the flow was going back on the birth control pill in my late 40s, a treatment not without risks, but risks I was willing to take. I never did get the hot flashes that plagued my mother. It turns out that your menopause doesn't necessarily mimic your mother's, nor does it have any obvious connection to your own reproductive history. Whether you had early easy pregnancies, tough ones, or none at all, scientists do know that women who have ever suffered a major depressive episode have a 59% greater chance of experiencing another one in perimenopause. They've also found suggestive links between childhood trauma and severity of menopause symptoms, and there are hints that women who had PMS will experience more mood issues. But experts are still teasing out all these relationships, which are multi-layered and complex. In my early 50s, I went off the pill to see if things had settled down. They had. Eventually, after a year without bleeding, I was diagnosed as having gone through menopause. I was done, and that was a relief. I was glad to say goodbye to periods, glad to be liberated from the emergency fortifications I'd grown used to carting around, glad to no longer be ruled by a cycle and instead be able to focus on myself and my own idiosyncratically shifting needs. A lot of work goes into being a woman of childbearing age. Mine was finished, and I'd had it relatively easy. My husband had a vasectomy when we were in our 30s, so I'd already enjoyed years of not needing to give one single thought to birth control. Plus, I'd never faced the risks that fertility brings for women and girls in many parts of the world. The UN Population Fund, UNFPA, has reported that every 2 minutes, a woman dies from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes. Depending on where you live, menstruation-based discrimination can lead to shunning, harassment, lost school days, lost wages, and according to UNFPA, transactional sex to pay for menstrual supplies. For me, a lucky middle-class American, getting to menopause was a new kind of freedom. For other women, it is salvation. I did wonder, though, what's the point of menopause in evolutionary terms? What's the advantage of a trait that makes reproduction impossible? In almost every other animal species, not counting killer whales, short-finned pilot whales, belugas, and narwhals, females can bear young until nearly their dying day. Yet women lose that ability and then go on to live another third of their life. Paleontologists have suggested that, far from being merely an aberration among humans, menopause is what made us human. The so-called grandmother hypothesis, which gained traction in the 1990s, thanks to field data gathered by anthropologist Kristen Hawkes of the University of Utah, posits that menopause gave our forebears the chance to evolve some of our most salient beneficial traits. As the theory goes, early humans lived in multi-generation kinship groups, and the postmenopausal women in these groups, lacking young children of their own, played a critical role in aiding the survival of their offspring's children, who, living to adulthood, were able to procreate and pass on their grandmother's longevity genes. This, in turn, allowed for the evolution of more complex brains and the development of cooperation and sociability. Nicely done, cave ladies. Scientists may still be years away from obliterating hot flashes. Even female scientists with a lot at stake personally. Even rock star female scientists who vacation together in California wine country at the Mayo Clinic's, as the Mayo Clinic's Stephanie Phobion recently did with incoming NAMS president and hot flash specialist Rebecca Thurston and cognition authority Pauline Makey. Women's health experts, they're just like us. But while we can't yet put a stop to our internal conflagrations, we can redefine what it means to have them. A box reads, "You're getting warmer. What's happening when you flash?" Experts aren't certain about the exact mechanism driving hot flashes, flushing, and night sweats, but we have an idea thanks in large part to women scientists like Rebecca Thurston, PhD at the University of Pittsburgh, Pauline Makey, PhD at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and Naomi Rance, MD, PhD at the University of Arizona, not to mention a cadre of overheated rodents. Rance has worked with lab rats to identify which neurons are involved when their tail skin vasodilates, their version of a hot flash. Here's what we know. Starting in perimenopause, your internal thermostat goes on the fritz. The part of your brain responsible for sensing and controlling body heat overreacts to even slight changes in core body temp. This is likely due in part to estrogen withdrawal, Thurston says, but could also be due to extreme estrogen fluctuations. The neurotransmitters norepinephrine and serotonin play a role, as do special neurons in the hypothalamus, but more research is required to know exactly how they factor in. Most women report noticing triggers that make them flash, for example, spicy food, stress, or red wine. However, Thurston and her team haven't been able to manipulate these possible culprits to induce hot flashes in the lab. We've tried to warm women up with special heating pads, stress them out by asking them to, say, perform difficult math tasks, but they're just as likely to flash while sitting calmly. Thurston would know. She monitors participants' brain, heart, and blood vessels so she can measure when they're flashing, even when they don't realize they are. Neurons in the brain are activated, and the hypothalamus sends out the signal that the body needs to cool down. In response, you experience vasodilation, widening of your veins, arteries, and capillaries to increase blood flow and dissipate heat, as well as the cursed sweating. You may be oversensitive to drops in body temperature too, which is why clamminess, shivering, and chills often follow hot flashes. The hot flash can last from 1 to 15 minutes, usually closer to 5, before your body temperature returns to the comfortable range. The process can continue for 7 to 9 years. That's the mean duration, although a third of women flash for longer. It's not uncommon to have hot flashes into your 70s or beyond. Scientists are working on finding a reliable predictor of when they will stop. The problem with not fully understanding how and why flashes happen is that it limits the development of new treatments. Hormone therapy can be very effective, but it's not the best option for every woman, and other treatments come with side effects and caveats too. But some explosive new findings could change everything. Thanks to Thurston and other scientists, it's now believed that hot flashes may be associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease, the number one killer of women, says Stephanie Fobion of NAMS. Adds Thurston, we've seen that women with more and more frequent hot flashes, upward of 4 in a day, often have signs of underlying vascular dysfunction that can put them at risk for future cardiovascular issues. We don't think hot flashes cause the dysfunction. They just help identify women who have it. Showing the connection isn't meant to scare women, says Fobion. On the contrary, it could be the thing that saves them by directing public interest and all-important research dollars into this hot-button menopausal symptom. A box reads, "Do this in your 40s. Thank yourself in your 60s. You'll never drop dead of a hot flash, but flashes and other perimenopausal symptoms are red flags, telling you it's time to get serious about your health," says Tara Allman, MD, a board-certified gynecologist in New York City. "The great news is that you already know how. Just follow the advice your doctor has been repeating for years. They give you all this information about healthy habits in your 20s or 30s, but women that age often shrug it off," says Siobhan Harlow, PhD, a professor of epidemiology and global public health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Then you hit midlife and your body stops bouncing back the way it used to, is it ironic that we finally have to take healthy living seriously just when so many of us are feeling too stressed and sluggish to do so? Yes, but think of these lifestyle changes as a gift to your fabulous future self. Practice good sleep hygiene. It seems like a cruel joke to suggest that women plagued by night sweats and insomnia need to sleep better, but doing so is vital to your well-being now and forever. When you're rested, you're more likely to have healthier food choices and to exercise, be in a better mood, and have sharper cognition. So make sleep hygiene your religion, though thou shalt not drink alcohol after dinner or binge on Netflix until 1 a.m. And if the goddess of Z's still forsakes you, speak to a psychologist about insomnia or a sleep specialist about apnea. Lower your stress. It can take a serious toll on your physical and mental health. Research shows benefits from regular exercise and meditation, but also consider talking to a therapist, especially if you're prone to depression, which can put you at greater risk of having a depressive episode in perimenopause. And don't forget your friends. Social interaction is a known mood booster. Get heart smart. Talk to your doc about cardiovascular risk factors like high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, and diabetes. Eat healthy. More plants, whole grains, poultry, and fish. Less saturated fat, sodium, red meat, and processed foods. And commit to aerobic workouts, at least 150 minutes a week, of moderate intensity activity. If you've been prescribed heart meds, take them. And note that as frequent hot flashes during perimenopause may be associated with increased cardiovascular disease risk, all of this advice is crucial for flashers. Rebuild strong bones. A decrease in estrogen can accelerate the natural loss of bone. Make sure you're getting enough vitamin D during weight-bearing, doing weight-bearing exercises like running, jumping rope, and squat jumps. They help build bone in addition to growing muscle, and practicing yoga, which can help reinforce bones while improving balance. Maintain a healthy weight. With age, we lose muscle mass and our metabolism slows, both of which can lead to weight gain. On average, midlife women gain 1.5 pounds per year, which often shows up in the midsection as a result of decreasing estrogen levels. Fat in the abdominal area can increase the risk of serious conditions, including diabetes, breast cancer, and cardiovascular disease. Following all the above advice will help ward off weight gain, as will lifting weights to build calorie-burning muscle. Quit smoking. It makes every other health issue worse. A box reads, "Your bag of tricks." The change is going to come. With these supplies, you'll be ready. Leak-proof underwear in bikini and French cuts and fetching rose and periwinkle shades. Speaks, SPEEAX by Thinks. THINX undies may not look like they can hold up to 8 teaspoons of urine, but they can, and they eliminate odor too, from $28 per pair. She thinks, shethinx.com. Portable fan, behold one of civilization's great achievements, the rechargeable W fan. You wear it around your neck, position the two fan heads to your liking, and blast away hot flashes with cool, cool air. At the highest of the three speeds, you can almost achieve liftoff. $37, WFANUSA.com. Sleep supplements, hope for the middle-aged and the restless. Preliminary research suggests that CBT may help with sleep. Try Plant People's Drops Plus Sleep from $79. Plant People, period, CO. But check with your doctor first, as CBT can affect certain meds. The Maximum Max. You never know when the prodigal period will make a sudden and dramatic reappearance. Keep at least one heavy flow pad with wings, you'll thank us, and an ultra absorbent tampon in your bag at all times. Catherine Keller. Better bedding, the next best thing to snoozing on ice. Sheeks, S-H-E-E-X, performance sheets are made of a moisture-wicking polyester spandex fabric from $179. Sheeks.com. You may sweat, but you won't stay wet. Vajayjay Moisturizer and Lube. Keep hydrated down there by applying a moisturizing lotion every few days, like the gyno-recommended Replens, R-E-P-L-E-N-S, long-lasting vaginal moisturizer, $16, Replens.com for stores, and using lube before sex, like Pink Silicone, $23, PinkSensuals.com, or Good Clean Loves, water-based, almost naked, organic personal lubricant, $12. GoodCleanLove.com can help you stay in the erogenous zone. Another box reads, proceed with caution. Some women with distressing menopause symptoms are willing to try almost anything to relieve them. Here are two common treatments to think twice about. Custom compounded bioidentical hormones. These pills, creams, gels, shots, and implanted pellets are made at compounding pharmacies based on an individual patient's needs. While they aren't necessarily bad, they're not always what they seem. None of them are FDA approved, which means they aren't required to meet the government's labeling, safety, and quality control standards. As a result, customized compounded hormones can vary in their purity and potency. This is why such products are frowned upon by not only the FDA, but also the North American Menopause Society and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Vaginal rejuvenation. You may have heard some buzz about lasers or radio frequency devices that can solve all your vaginal woes, but the procedures are expensive, the results are only temporary, and none are FDA approved or cleared for the treatment of menopause-related symptoms. In fact, last year, the FDA explicitly warned that their effectiveness and safety in treating such symptoms has not been established. The article continues, because the truth is, menopause is not an end, it's a beginning. a searing initiation, a crucible in which a more essential version of ourselves is forged. We go through the fire and come out refined, able, often for the first time ever, to focus on the things we care about most. And yes, we can focus. Mackie says the brain fog related to the loss of estrogen in perimenopause dissipates postmenopause, possibly because in a scenario researchers are at this very minute exploring, the brain develops its own ingenuous neurological workarounds. What do most of our most formidable, fearless leaders have in common? They're women who came to the fullness of their powers on the other side of menopause, and now they're running Congress, Nancy Pelosi, running for president, Elizabeth Warren, sitting on the Supreme Court, RBG. Think of Christine Lagarde, Patti Smith, Ruth E. Carter, Sister Helen Prejean, all forces to be reckoned with as younger women, but none of them as deeply visionary, as thoroughly glorious as when they got to the other side. And then there's Belinda Frears, that Kristen Scott Thomas character in Fleabag, a successful businesswoman who in one episode has a martini at a bar with the show's obviously smitten 33-year-old female protagonist. At 58, Belinda is every inch her own awesome dame, knowing, confident, worldly, humane, and damn sexy, and she has wisdom to share. Being a woman, Belinda says, is about pain. Women are born to pain, what with the cramps, the aching breasts, the childbirth, and so forth. And then, just when you feel you are making peace with it all, what happens? The menopause comes. The fucking menopause comes, and it is the most wonderful fucking thing in the world. Yes, your entire pelvic floor crumbles, and you get fucking hot, and no one cares, but then you're fine. No longer a slave, no longer a machine with parts. You're just a person in business. It is horrendous, but then it's magnificent. Something to look forward to. Wouldn't you raise a glass to that? Additional reporting by Serena Alagappan, Corey Pickool, and Deborah Way. Also from the October issue of Oprah. Behind the book, a recipient of the National Book Award and a MacArthur Genius Grant, Ta-Nehisi Coates, 44, has explored the importance of archetypes, especially as they relate to the African-American story. In his previous books, The Beautiful Struggle Between the World and Me and We Were 8 Years in Power, but he's been thinking about how myths mold our perspective pretty much his whole life. At 5, he says, I was in the back seat of my parents' red station wagon, talking about my favorite television show, the Tarzan, Lone Ranger, Zora Adventure Hour, and I told my dad how much I loved Tarzan. His father, Paul, dubbed Conscious Man by his son in The Beautiful Struggle, was skeptical. As a member of the Black Panther Party and devotee of obscure works about African and African-American history, Paul never missed a chance to school his son about his heritage. In this case, he wanted Ta-Nehisi to understand the subtext of the Tarzan legend and to know that his dad objected to this white man in the jungles of Africa acting like a hero among savages. Paul told Ta-Nehisi he wouldn't be allowed to watch Tarzan until he could see for himself the racist undertones and there was more to it than the adventures of a guy in a loincloth swinging from vine to vine. In fact, his son would be barred from watching any TV for a week while he worked out why the story shouldn't be taken at face value. What could possibly be wrong with Tarzan? Coates recalls thinking. Over the next few weeks, he and his father debated Paul. Paul shared books and images for context and expounded on why only certain types of people are portrayed as heroes in our history and literature. What Coates now calls the knowledge started to sink in. He kept watching Tarzan, but returned again and again to his father's words. "Those were my first deep lessons," he says. Coates was an early reader. His mom was a school teacher who instructed him herself. By the time he got to first grade, he remembers wondering why everyone read so slow. At home, in his bedroom, he pored over a set of Childcraft encyclopedias and spent hours at the Enoch Pratt Free Library, winning a prize for getting through the most books in a summer. "School," he says, "was something I did to keep people off my back. Learning was something I did on my own." Coates' parents allowed him to have action figures only with black skin. For instance, Roadblock and Stalker, the black soldiers who back up G.I. Joe. He also loved comic books. Superheroes' exploits transported him out of West Baltimore, where kids worried about getting beaten up or shot. "I knew that to be afraid while on the way to school was deeply wrong," he writes in The Beautiful Struggle. Although there were few black characters in the Marvel Universe, apart from Black Panther, Falcon, and Luke Cage, Coates detected in the X-Men, and particularly Spider-Man, an underdog quality he identified with. "I never thought of Peter Parker as white," he says. "If anything, I related him to black people because he was poor and always trying to do the right thing most of the time. There was no reward waiting for him at the end. It wasn't about skin color. It was about where you existed in society."